Der Feierkultur-Podcast mit Julian und Leonie.
Fantastic Gesamtkunst, a limitless, borderless, happy convergence of ideas where all you'll have to do is nothing, because we're at your service, and a new world.
Jeremy.
Hi.
Hi,
good
Jeremy.
To have you here. Your name is Jeremy Wade, and I give you a little introduction to our audience.
Okay.
We both met a couple of weeks ago at Wilde Renate, where you have a one-year residency called The Puddles Rising. You were performing an incredible performance, to be honest. It was really amazing. I was so overwhelmed. Ask Julian.
Yeah, I think she was.
Yeah, I was really fascinated. But step by step, let me introduce you. And you have made a name for yourself as an extreme performer and a performance maker. Your work is something, and sometimes also a bit disturbing maybe for people. Very, very special. And also maybe a bit provoking. It revolves around queer and feminist strategies and the complicated, sort of now. You grew up in the US and made yourself a name in New York City as a hooker. You were part of the club kit and party promoter.
Mm-hmm.
You say about yourself, I was working my ass off by bartending, go-go dancing, painting apartments, turning tricks and barely surviving the big badass apple. Is that correct?
Yes. Needs to be put into context. But I said that at a certain point.
At some point you said that. You even threw your own parties at the famous gay bar, The Hook, The Cook?
The Cock.
Sorry?
There were no cooks in sight.
No.
I wouldn't eat anything from there.
Yeah.
Except...
different cooks, maybe. Jeremy, I could go on and on and on, but please, I think you can describe yourself in better words. Tell us about your journey and what eventually brought you to Berlin.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So I think this question of who is Jeremy Wade, I think this idea of a unified narrative is kind of tricky. I think we tell ourselves and our surroundings stories about ourselves, but then that's just a part of the equation. So when you're an artist, the public perspective is also part of that. And it's then this kind of swarm. And that's great because you can just kind of let it go.
Mm.
However, there's another Jeremy Wade who's like the real Jeremy Wade, and he's the Jeremy Wade River Monsters guy. And I receive emails from his fans. So that's always a good thing. So he's the one that will go to your backyard and like find the Loch Ness monster in the puddle. And sometimes I get these emails saying like, I'm a really good cook. I live in Montana. I'm a single mom and I'm a huge fan. Yeah. So, I don't reply. I just collect them.
Yeah. Why?
yeah, I don't know. I think it would be mean to pop the bubble somehow. Yeah. Yeah. So there are lots of Jeremy Wades. I guess maybe it's more important to talk about like some of the things that kind of were embedded into my practice and the way that I perceive things. So that being said, like I grew up in a really rural environment. Both of my parents were low-income social workers. Mm-hmm. Our house was a halfway house for drug addicts and sex workers and kids that were homeless. My father had been in prison for many years and was in recoveries. That was also a big part of like the language and the environment that I was in. I really grew up in rural Maine. So like a mill town in the Northeast that smelled like rotten eggs. Mm. And so the education was just as similar to the smell in a way.
I know Maine only from Stephen King books, I think.
It's actually a really good way to nail it. Yeah. He nails it.
Yeah.
And he also has a real deep reverence for the state. So Kathy Bates, Misery, Dirty Birdie. As a kid, I had learning difficulties, and I also had some pretty intense behavior problems. So what that meant was like, I couldn't sit down in class and I would get like intense report cards saying, you know, that Jeremy can't do what he's told and all that stuff. So I guess also I was effeminate. I had these behavior problems and I was super conscious at a young age of like how kind of power operated. So I think there were many moments where like I would make some kind of broad effeminate gesture or do some musical thing and I just get shut down immediately because that wasn't okay. Mm. It was a hyper-masculine space. It was a very cold place. It's very internal. And so along the way, I kind of developed some coping strategies. And one would be that like a big part of the way that I survived was being an intense asshole trickster. So I would basically, as a kid, just kind of completely destroy or disrupt a situation before I could get into a position where I would get picked on as a kid. Mm-hmm. And it actually worked.
So like a defense.
Oh, it was a total defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. And I also built a name for myself for like the kid that would like do the weirdest thing at the weirdest time. At the time, Dances with Wolves with Kevin Costner, and people would call me Dances with Swans because I would take the shit off of people's lawns and I would do some performance on the lawn. And then it was also vandalism.
Okay.
just be honest. And I'm not, but in retrospect, it was a mode of survival.
Yeah.
I think I really started to identify and belong when I started going to hardcore shows and raves.
Hardcore as electronic or hardcore as guitar?
No, more like skate punk, Fugazi.
Yeah, yeah. Straight edge scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it was really powerful. Mm-hmm. And music was always a big part of my family life. Like my father was a huge music fan. My mother was really into musicals and jazz. And so we just listened to music all the time. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I really began to own my own taste in music and choices. And then dance was also a really big part of that. So yeah, then kind of this mode of like destroying the situation shifted into the social code of social dance. And in the States, especially during the rave scene in the early 90s, yes, I'm that old. people didn't even know what the fuck it was. Yeah. You know, you'd go to parties and they were just completely legal. And this was before the demonization and like, you know, the way that TV somehow demonized the rave scene.
Yeah. Mm.
And social dance in the States is really competitive and it's really virtuosic, but it's really also about improvising. Mm-hmm. And those break beats would come in that kind of bridge between house and techno. And it was really amazing. Also, the dress at the time, you know, it was so cartoon-esque. Mm. It wasn't like, you know, you're wearing a Ralph Lauren polo sport suit or something. No, it was like you're going to the Salvation Army and you have a glow stick and an imagination and you're putting something crazy together. Mm. And then the drugs just ended up making us these kind of animated little child gangsters. occasionally turn into ice cream cones. Yeah. And then like laser robots. Yeah.
I kind of had the same experience also of coming from hardcore, from like really, you know.
The robot situation.
No, more like music-wise, you know, the emo core. Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's also extreme. And then, you know, the next most extreme thing music-wise was electronic music, was techno. It just came up in the beginning of the 90s. And you became also a little part of the Club Kids scene there that was going on. And
well, that this is still in Maine, yeah. I'm still in high school, so I had a really hard time in high school, and I wasn't a very good student. This was before people understood learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. I would get into algebra, and I would just cry intensely because I just couldn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. And so I barely graduated high school, mm-hmm. and I had kind of no prospect, no longing for something to do really in the future. So I ended up going to this state school in the middle of nowhere, deeper in the middle of Maine. Mm-hmm. And as an elective, I took a modern dance class with this woman who was teaching principles of postmodernist dance and mm-hmm. contact improvisation in the middle of nowhere.
That's odd somehow, right?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm. I think teachers are like, especially teachers that are like in rural places, like really have unimaginable power.
Yeah.
And she was really kind and she was really supportive. And she saw this light bulb go off. And she also saw that like I had no dance training and I came from bullshit. And she didn't, you know, blink an eye. She just said, if you want to do this, this is how. Hmm. So basically, I took her super seriously and something had clicked.
Also for the first time, probably, right?
That you, really that for you the take first time. So out of the blue. I was 19 years old. Mm. Nothing had ever connected in this way for me, besides music and dancing and being an asshole. And so I ended up going to a festival in Massachusetts, whatever, and just meeting like another kind of guru along the way. And this person also gave me the thumbs up, but was just like, you know, if you're a plumber, you'll deal with just as much shit as you will deal with being an artist. So I'm not sure it's a good idea, but just giving a warning. I should have taken the warning and become a plumber. I would have had a retirement by now. I got on a bus and moved to New York City. Mm-hmm. And this person that I had met at this festival was from the Lower East Side. Their name was Mark Dendy, and they still are a dancer, choreographer, performance maker, and they did drag. Mm-hmm. And their first character was called Sandy Sheets, and they were really also part of ACT UP in the AIDS crisis. And so this person embedded in me like a brief history of something that I really wanted. And I got there, and upon advice, Mark said, listen, just when you get there, go to Squeeze Box on Friday night, take all of your clothes off, get on the bar, and dance in front of Michael Schmidt. And if he likes you, he'll hire you. Yeah. And he did.
As a bartender or as a
go-go dancer?
As a go-go dancer.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't doing any kind of like professional go-go dancing. Mm. I mean, I was just...
But Mr. Schmidt, his name was.
Yeah.
He took notice of you.
He did. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, that's where I went on Friday nights. And I met all the people that were part of that scene. And then I quickly met people who owned this bar called Cake. And that was another hot spot. I would say it was the end of the AIDS crisis and mm-hmm. the beginning of the crystal meth epidemic. Mm-hmm. The Club Kids had just... It was the summer that Michael Alec had gone to prison.
Yeah. Okay. Where everything kind of went down. from that scene.
Yeah, it was a bookend in a way. But it was still a possibility space.
Yeah.
And there were still incredible characters, like with incredible histories connected to different scenes in different cities. But primarily there was this thing of like, there was the Chelsea scene in the LGBT community, which was like middle class, white, super beefy, you know, like giant bodies, tiny heads. Like that was the aesthetic, you know, tiny gym shorts. And then there were the weirdos. And
the canary birds, kind of.
The canary birds, the birds with one eye, the
puddles.
I left New York City in 2006.
Yeah.
So I think one way to encapsulate it, like from my own kind of lived experience, arriving in 1995, from 1995 to September 11th, 2001, for me, I feel very grateful to have experienced that period.
Yeah.
I mean, one interesting fact is that The Cock, which was a bar that I worked at three nights a week, it was a kind of counterpublic that you can't really imagine. It was such a diverse mix of people. You had the Lower East Side four blocks down. You had Bellevue Hospital, one of the biggest mental hospitals in the galaxy, four blocks up. You know, you had celebrities kind of flocking there with East Village punks and activists and queers of all kinds. And it was the dirtiest gay bar in the universe. I mean, if you sat on the couch, you would absolutely get syphilis.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was all kind of relegated by cruising, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The music was amazing. The DJs were amazing. There was a different party every night. I threw a party there on Monday night called Chicken, where Amanda Lepore and Sophie Lamar would like kind of walk around naked in a pair of heels with a chicken head on their heads. You know, every once in a while, they'd pull eggs out of their pussy and they'd like cock-a-doodle-doo. And it was amazing, you know. It didn't make any money.
Of course not.
But it was really fun. Yeah. And during the time, Giuliani was mayor, and he put the Department of Sanitation in charge of policing the gay clubs. It's intentional.
Sanitation, yeah.
Clean up the dirty faggots.
Make that away.
That's like, right?
Just get rid of it.
Yeah. And so, yeah, clubs would be raided like constantly. Dancing was like illegal in most clubs because they enforced these cabaret laws.
Like a year ago.
Right. And yeah, I mean, it was fucked up. It was not perfect, but I think that's what made it kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Twin Towers fell.
Yeah, right.
And I had a nasty crystal meth habit.
Mm-hmm.
Oops. Mm-hmm. And I ended up kind of like falling out of the club scene. You know, I had I was technically doing well for myself. Well, I won't use the word well, but there was nothing healthy about it. But I had a party at Flamingo East right before the towers fell with Honey Dijon. It was like, it was cool. Mm-hmm. It was like off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
But after the towers, the city went into this mega shock doctrine of gentrification. And I made like a deep commitment to myself to like take care of myself and also like really step up to the plate and pursue my career as a choreographer.
And that was also the time when you decided to leave New York City and go to Berlin in 2006?
No. So from the time of September 11th, 2001 to 2006, I had a job as a personal assistant for a famous psychic.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And it was really easy. And that's really what I needed. And it was really super structured. I would walk his Cairn Terrier. I would pay his bills. I would be nice to clients. I would get him lunch, organize things, clean things, whatever he needed.
Was it difficult for you to just like change the topic of your job so drastically?
it was deeply necessary. I didn't really have a choice. Mm-hmm.
So that was also like for you and for your like health.
Yeah, I was pretty fucked. Yeah. And I had hit bottom, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And hitting bottom, it's a jumping off point. don't worry about it. You have no belongings. Well, that's no checked baggage. So it ended up being this place where not only did the job provide structure, but I lived in a shared 3,000 square foot loft in Bushwick. Mm-hmm. That was still possible then. Mm-hmm. It's now Gagosian Gallery or some shit. And I spent the majority of my time in the studio. And I think tracking all the way back to being an effeminate kid who was sensitive to the way power kind of played out, when I moved to New York City, I didn't stop taking notes. Mm-hmm. I have this memory for like behavior in public. I have this memory for music, and I have a memory for like situations and the way that they occurred or the way I think they occurred. Mm-hmm. And I really started to use that. I was in this reading group with Andrea Lepecki studying theory at the time, a lot of post-structuralist Lacanian theories of like, identity and becoming, and everything really started to click. My dance education really started to click, and I didn't really know what the fuck to do after my dance education. But then when I really started to take it seriously and get in the studio, I had all of a sudden a practice. Mm-hmm. Like I knew what to do there. So the first piece that I made was called Glory. Mm-hmm. There was one solo that kind of was the predecessor to that. And I ended up kind of looking at this kind of emotional, behavioral, and abstract body. Abstract meaning like the language of dance. I ended up kind of making a language based on those uncomfortable moments, the cringing after the thing that you said, wanting to take it back, avoidance mechanisms in public, watching people like get disgusted by a smell or thing. I was taking also movement really from like the height of ecstasy in a club, mm-hmm. Those ecstatic intimate moments, and somehow making these connections and really making a dance around the politics of ecstasy, mm-hmm. making a dance about how power plays out on the body. A body that has no power, a body of like heightened arrogance and monstrosity and going back and forth between them. And I won an award for it. I got some recognition for it. And it took 3 years to make, which is almost ridiculous in hindsight.
Yeah.
But the funding was just very minimal, you know? So I had this job, I had my studio practice, I had like these things kind of piecing together my life. And I'm also I'm proud of that person as well. Mm-hmm. Like good job, because it's hard to step up to the plate and make that first brush stroke. Yeah. And when I look back at the piece now, the decisions that I made were intensely strange, and they weren't arbitrary. The composition itself was strange enough to be able to house those sites of like incomprehensible degradation, mm-hmm. And then slowly crawling, spiraling, moving towards some kind of ecstasy of surrender and some kind of like power. But it wasn't a power of like the people that have power. It's a power of recognizing and channeling your own vulnerability and making that shine.
So when you like build up something out of almost nothing, I would say, like in the beginning of the 2000s, and you build up your career, and then decided to leave again from the city, which is how come?
Like, well, what made you move to Berlin?
Because I had, I was on the front cover of the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. My parents were like, "Whoa," and I had literally no opportunities for funding. Mm-hmm. And I knew some friends in Europe who were getting funding and getting their work supported. And I got an invite to perform at Tanzfabrik, to perform Glory, mm-hmm. at Tanzfabrik.
Okay.
So I spent a little time here, and that was it. Yeah. I was, you know, I packed everything in 6 duffel bags. Most of it was shoes and books, and accessoires. And I moved here.
The zombie apocalypse are going, la, 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 but fuck that. We're out with the surfers. That's where it's at. In the bay. Ha! Oh, and we're a full of feathers. And we swoop up.
I moved here in 2006, like I said, with 6 duffel bags. And my friend Caden Manson was working at the Hebel HaMufer. And I had a few friends from New York City that were working with him. And he basically introduced me to Bettina Mazuk and Matthias Lilienthal. Mm-hmm. And it was after like maybe 2 months that I was there. I had a meeting with her during Tanz im August. Mm-hmm. It was one of the most uncomfortable meetings I ever had in my life.
Why?
because she, it was stiff, and she's an amazing curator, and I have a lot of respect for her. But she's also a tough cookie, and she was not having the package that I was kind of presenting or what I was trying to sell her. But then she watched the entirety of my first solo there in the office, and I was sweating.
Yeah.
Bullets. And after that, she said, I'm going to help you to apply for funding. And if you get it, we'll help you to make your first piece.
Oh. How did that go?
Did it work out?
It did. I got the funding. Mm-hmm. And so I've been working at the Hebel HaMufer ever since. Mm-hmm. And I think it was also a very unique time. Berlin was just beginning to be the cultural renaissance that it is now. Mm. And I think it is a tough field to be a freelance artist in this city.
Yeah.
But it was easier then. Mm. And I don't know if people would get the same kind of meeting or opportunity. Mm. Also, knowing someone and having my foot in the door there was good. And I'm lucky as fuck to be supported by the Hebel HaMufer since 2006, to be working with Hakave, Sophie Insela, and to be a part of the field of cultural production in Berlin. I have so much respect for not only the artists that make the scene what it is, but also the cultural workers, because without them, this support structure wouldn't be there. And especially during the lockdown, it was the people from that scene, actually, from the Freiheit scene of contemporary performance in Berlin that ended up getting demanding that freelance artists be taken care of with this COVID support. And I had friends in New York City who were literally picking through the trash and joining food co-ops because they were hungry.
Yeah, yeah.
And these were celebrated artists with Guggenheim fellowships and MacArthur fellowships.
How hard is it, especially if you're an artist, especially the funding, do you then take care of that yourself? Or do you, because I couldn't imagine of those two sides that are so opposite, you know, of taking care of all the applications and everything you need. And on the other hand, making your art.
Often we see the artwork, but very rarely do we see the work of art. So this song is about that. Yes. And so much goes into, you know, the choreography, the coordinography, the dance of that social fabric of different labor relations. And may we support each other and also be supported. So I would like to take this opportunity to thank Christian in the booth. Thank you very much. Also, my very special blue-eyed cockatoo, Darcy Bennett, in the front row. So this song is dedicated to the activities director, the stage manager on the cruise ship, and her name is Elizabeth Knauf. And she also works at the Hebel am Ufer sometimes in Berlin. And this bitch is golden. This bitch is a rock. And I aspire to rocks because Puddles is a fucking mess. But, you know, some people pray to Venus, I pray to rocks. And so, Elizabeth, this song is for you.
Show. Girl's feathers, stage pink colors, torch song phoenix, social worker weaver.
Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, a matriarchal support structure. A clipboard with all the notes in it and all the details. The lights, the da-da-da. The plucks. The person who mops the floor diligently. Oh, look how it shines for you. Oh, oh, whoa. Clap, clap, clap. Quack, quack, quack.
Can you feel it?
Hey!
Medley.
But I don't want to feel my feelings anymore when it's over.
It sounds like Radiohead. Fuck it. And Elizabeth comes into the dressing room and she says, "What? Good job, honey. Go home and get some rest."
Show. Source of Phoenix.
You're golden. Thank you.
Within the freelance scene, and this is, I mean, maybe this would be a bridge to Puddles because she's also, she's a showgirl that's tired of smiling. please rate our performance on the way out. It's the green button, you asshole.
And so, because you mentioned Puddles, how did you find her?
Okay.
How was Puddles born?
So, in 2019, I made a piece called The Clearing. And I don't know, I would say since 2016, I had been focused on one refrain within queer theory, post-colonialism, disability studies, environmental studies, of the idea of the formulation of a difficult sense of hope. Mm. And that this sense of hope, despite its potential reality, was essential to like numerous civil rights movements throughout time. And I kind of charted it out through a lot of different ways. I played a dead clown who sold death to the audience. Mm-hmm. I played a battlefield nurse who's 5,000 years old and hosted a project called the Future Clinic for Critical Care. And in 2019, I've always had this recurring nightmare that I gave birth to something, but it was dead. Mm-hmm. And I pay close attention to my dreams. So I literally staged that in a kind of three-act performance called The Clearing. And the first act of The Clearing, I play a janitor in the deep future who gives birth to, who puts on this elaborate super techno laser ritual. Mm-hmm. With a pair of potato mashers in my hand and a blue see-through latex suit. And he goes about putting on this ordained ritual, and eventually part of the ritual is that he gives birth to the symbol. And the symbol dies, and it's devastating. It's super hardcore. And during the process, people were like, you can't end it like this. I know this is like integral to stage, but it's too much of a rupture. Mm-hmm. Like, why this form of disruption? And eventually I started to think through, like, who is the archetype? Who is the character? Who is the figure that can really deal with the death of hope? Mm-hmm. It wasn't the janitor in the deep future. Mm-hmm. And we ended up kind of problem solving and situating and building this character. And I realized in the beginning that it was a hag, a witch, a mother who had experienced deep loss. And so these images started to surface from the Deep Horizon oil spill, and this whole world began to emerge of Puddles.
Mm-hmm. I saw her. I saw Puddles at Renate, and it was actually mind-blowing and really touching. It was touching, and I think that was not what I expected when I got there. Just tell me how much of yourself, like Jeremy Wade, is within this character of Puddles, and why did you also chose this kind of figure to represent the story?
I think the first thing would be... thank you, by the way. And that show was also really special. I think part of what makes Puddles work is I just became super strict with myself as an artist to adhere to really clear formats. So I got really exhausted by the abstract nature of like art in general. And for me, like, I got really attracted to pop formats and really character building and world making. So my ex says that Puddles is more Jeremy Wade than Jeremy Wade is. quack, quack, quack. And in that way, I really aspire to her. And she's a broken, scrappy, one-eyed pelican who survived the Deep Horizon oil spill. she lost her sister in the oil spill. She was rescued by a cruise ship that is floating through hell at the end of time. And she's singing to you from the basement of the cruise ship on minus level 9. Hmm. She's a showgirl. So, you know, you can think of the whole spectrum of what that means to you. But there are many different facets of her character. So like one thing would be like, she's super tired of smiling. She's super critical about like doing this night after night. But then there's a certain point where she's doing this night after night after night after night. You know, so she's like, she loves what she does, but it's also killing her to a certain extent. Mm-hmm.
But it is a bit of your own story, right? Like so many parts of what you just explained to us now sounds so familiar to what Puddles is. And do you also like kind of speak through her?
I would say it's the other way around. Like I really couldn't sing until I started to embody this character. Mm. And to this day, like I can't sing unless I close one eye. And sometimes I find myself with one that eye open and I close it immediately on stage. So, I mean, she's many things. She's the address of Mother Earth. She's a whore. She's a showgirl. She's addicted. Mm. She's really super unhinged as a result of the trauma that she's experienced. Mm.
And the loss of her sister.
And this also, you know, it's not a kind of moral founding. It's like she's just a strange bird. Mm-hmm. And she makes really strange choices and she interrupts her sentences and she stutters and she's an improviser. But there are some other things in there that I wouldn't say are necessarily me. I do put my own personal stories into Puddles. Mm. But I do it in a way where I make the personal somehow public and accessible to other people. It's rounded out in the story so that people can experience their own relation to trauma and loss and mourning and celebration.
And I woke up on this cruise ship. These assholes on this cruise ship rescued me. And witches, they chanted things, and nurses, they lit candles. And they said, Puddles, your sister is no longer here. And I said, I don't know if I can do this. And they said, Puddles. And they said, well, they said, little bird, you got shows to do and sings to ha and wheeze to shiny things. And I was like, wow. And I was reminded of that song that my sister used to sing to me. It's gonna be okay, little bird. Oh. And if it's not gonna be okay, little bird, you gotta find the rhythm within. Oh, some shit. Maybe it's gonna be okay, little bird. Thank you. Sometimes it is okay, even when it's not okay. Oh, you know, the pain, it doesn't go away. But your life, it starts to grow around that. Oh, and baby, we do this night after night after night after night. bingo. Huddle up, bingo, the ball. You won. It's just your day. And it just so happens that we have unicorns.
I guess there's a central aspect to Puddles, which is like, she's irreverent. She's a badass. She's brutally honest. She's silly. And somehow, like, the child is always super accessible to her. It's right there. And she loves a shiny thing in a way, but of course it's like this animal attribute. But for me, it's also very much like she is in this kind of sustained sense of awe. Mm-hmm. Like, there are moments when she finds the beauty in, like, really in trash. And I think that's a really big part of my practice.
The flower and the trash.
The trash and the trash and the complexity of trash and, and the way the light is hanging in the space right now, doesn't matter where. And that our connection to a family or a network of things is possible, and that it's possible to move through deep trauma.
Is this also something what balances you, like finding your, what you just said, like finding the beauty in the trash and having like your, the strangeness the weirdness in this world, and that you just, that you still find something beautiful in it, even though it doesn't look beautiful, because this whole, what you just told us, like it sounded like a roller coaster life, big time. And at some point you have to find your balance somehow, right? And is Puddles your balance, sort of?
I made Puddles in 2019, and in the beginning she was the third act of this three-act show called The Clearing, and the piece was 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. And during the lockdown, I made about 3 hours worth of material. So, you know, Puddles says, paralyzed by the emptiness, me too, bitch. And it was really my coping strategy in a way. Yeah. I dove into making her work when most of my life was kind of unworking, actually. Yeah. And so at a certain point, I was taking anxiety, isolation, broken relationships, addiction, work addiction, loss of friendship, like all of this all of this stuff of life. Mm. And at a certain point, I was like, this song or this section is the spell that will save me or heal me to a certain extent. And I think that's actually bullshit. Mm-hmm. This is theater and it's not real. Mm. And it creates a possibility space of belonging, of shared intimacy, of shared stories. It's a process of like telling stories in order to kind of vivify the complicated now, to see through. It's the stuff that poetry does. It helps us to like sort through the bullshit stories and find like a clearing. Mm. Mm. But it's also just theater. And so, a real wake-up call for me was like, I have to take care of myself first and then rise to the occasion of this character.
And not the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're surrounded by a beautiful team there. Maybe we also mention them, your whole band, right? Trinati.
So that's really an evolution, a recent evolution. Since 2019 up until this summer, it's always been a piano duo. Mm-hmm. Originally, I started working with Mark Lohr, and then I started working with Quentin Tolomeri, who is now Sonny. And so I guess during the lockdown, I started reaching out to Gio from Trashera and sharing some of the Puddles stuff as it was evolving. Mm. And we had these small residencies along the way, one at Frankfurt Misanthrum and then Hakave, but very little. I mean, most of it is built from Corona. So Gio was like, I believe in this. It's true. And I was like, I really want a residency. Yeah. Like, and he was like, well, let's see if we can make it happen at Renata. Mm. And 6 months later, I had a meeting there. It was a very slow process. And it happened. Yeah. And now we actually have two residencies. Nice. We have a residency at Akud Maknoi that will start in December and one at Renata.
Nice.
And it's a dream. We're a five-piece band. So Quentin on keys, Zoe Jamila, backup vocals, Raj Prasad on bass, Liliana Zenjviza. I always mispronounce her name. She's going to fucking kill me. I call her Liliana the Lobster. And that resonates. And
we can put the names also in the info. Yeah.
Absolutely. She's fucking amazing. She's on drums. Yeah. And Philip Kulin on synth.
Yeah.
And you have a huge fan called Flo. From Renati.
Oh man. I mean,
he's the biggest fan.
Flo's just amazing. And you know, it's a commercial field. So it's also about selling 60 tickets a night. And that's a pain in the ass. Yeah. But Flo has shown up and like introduced me to you and I'm here and got us press and all this stuff. So
things are happening.
It's happening actually. Yeah. Like the vibe is on in the space. Really goes from incomprehensible loss and devastation and brokenness to a place of brightness and lightness and beauty and hope. And it's also coming from a legacy of drag, coming from a legacy of making stories for the people who need to hear them. And she's a good person to deliver a torch song. Mm. You know, she's a broken, busted bird who's like really been through it. Mm. And when she opens her beak to sing, in the end, it ends up being all the more powerful because you've taken an audience through all these different facets of her character. Mm. The muck, the brokenness, the uncomfortable moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it also is at the right place in Berlin, I think.
Yeah, definitely, definitely for the right people.
Renata, a classy shithole.
That's a good definition.
Jeremy, we could keep on talking about you, about puddles. I think there is a lot more. And I just want everyone to see your show.
Definitely.
I really want everyone to
click
see your
show. Click on the link in the info now and go there.
Buy the tickets.
Buy the tickets. Really. Do it. But yeah. We are almost in the end, but what is planned for the next weeks, month, for the until the end of the year? What's coming up?
So on November 23rd and 24th, we will show Act Two of the Puddles Saga. Mm-hmm. There's like three acts, and basically it's a piece that we made really mid lockdown. It's called The Howling Waveform Sum, and it deals with the broken stuff, the unworking stuff, not being able to read the room, miscommunication, isolation, anxiety, paranoia.
Also, yeah, a topic of the past 1.5 years, right?
For many, many people.
Yes. For many, many people.
And I didn't want to make a COVID specific, oh my God, no. But we wrote these new experiences into the myth that already exists, you know, into the character and this big, the world that she embodies. The piece is called The Howling Waveform Sum. We'll have the whole band, 23, 24, at Renata. We cover three songs from Benjamin Smoke, who was an amazing drug-addicted, HIV-positive, trans queen in Cabbage Town, Georgia, really big inspiration to REM and Michael Stipe and Neil Young, who is making super avant-garde torch songs of unworkingness. And, you know, he's not in the pop arcana because the music was far too difficult for people to deal with. But we try to do it justice in this show, and it's great that Puddles can really embody that. And then we're using this poetry from Ezra Green, written specifically for Puddles and for this show. So the show is 2 hours in its entirety. And the first act is this act two. And the second set is just really a song to song buildup. Yeah.
Nice. So
go
good,
there.
Good things are coming.
Quack, quack, quack.
Quack, quack, quack.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you
so much. Thanks. Thank you. It is amazing to listen to you, to your story. And yeah, it's a deep dive into
Next year is part two, I hope.
Yeah.
Cool. Pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Ah, and maybe it's important to say we have a lot of links. Yeah. What we include in our Spotify. And also, maybe we can listen to a bit more of Puddles now.
Cool. And also, www.puddlesthepelican.show.
Yes.
On your website.
Click it and buy the ticket.